a shot in the dark. Wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, here we go, kids. Episode 268. 268. I am broadcasting today from a bunker hidden under a center of the new evangelization, nestled somewhere in the Rocky Mountains, not unlike NORAD. we're in the pro booth today here. So yesterday you got, you're just getting all kinds of treats this week. So yesterday, I take that back. Yesterday was a podcast. You didn't get to hear this. So I'll tell you that there is a new episode of the Over the Counter podcast. So all of you contrarians out there that listen to both shows, me and Mark did, I think, what is probably our best podcast ever. So you can go just Google Over the Counter, and there's a overthecounter1.podbean.com, I think is the, but just Google Over the Counter and you can find us. So we're on iTunes as well. If you've already subscribed, really good podcast. Me and Mark Gieschek did, he's back in town and we're rolling. So today I have a special treat for you. And I know what you're thinking. No, not that special treat. Not Chris special treat Stefanik. A different special treat. Coming back to us. You've had the pleasure before. Please welcome the lovely and talented Paul McCusker.
Hi. Good to be back with you. After that introduction, I wasn't quite sure where to go.
Hey, I didn't call you.
I'm still back at the bunker part.
I didn't. So that's what anytime I'm recording from one of the basement levels at the Augustine Institute, I always say that I am in a bunker hidden under the center of the new evangelization, nestled somewhere in the Rockies, not unlike NORAD. Mm-hmm. It's one of my little...
or nothing like NORAD.
One of my little vocal tics here. I love on radio, like little repeated things. Like I make fun of Rush Limbaugh sometimes, and I'll say, I have here in my pile of things.
Yeah, that's right. If you rustle some paper.
Yeah, because stack of stuff.
Or drum your fingers. I think he was like one of the first I ever heard on radio, because being involved in radio for years and years and years, and all those rules they tell you about.
Yeah.
That things you don't do. And then Rush Limbaugh came along and started breaking them all.
I mean, like him or not, Limbaugh is a master of the of that broadcast medium. Mm-hmm. And I always think, yeah, I'm sure Stack of Stuff is probably copyrighted. So I say, I have here in my pile of things, and I rustle, rustle. And I'm like, I hold here in my formerly dark roast stained fingers. So it's 2 days in a row I've been in this booth with someone else, but yesterday wasn't on the counter position. It was over the counter with Mark.
That's right.
So if you haven't heard before, Paul McCusker of Adventures in Odyssey fame. Mm-hmm. You're one of the founders, and you are the founder, I guess, of the
not the originator, but I came in very early on.
Yeah,
so
you,
I'm sort of part of the original team.
I meant to tell you this. I had never heard Adventures in Odyssey, right? And I'd heard you talk about it. I knew that this was something that was a staple in evangelical world, especially with kids growing up, and that you were kind of, you're like fairly famous in that world because of that. I was in my car driving from, I think it was... I was driving across Kansas coming through. I bought a car over the break and I was driving across Kansas and I was just surfing and I came across Adventures in Odyssey. And that's so funny. I listened to the bulk of an episode.
Yeah. Which I think is how a lot of people discover it and listen to it.
Right.
It's drive time radio. I mainly radio theater.
Oh, did it?
The funny thing about Adventures in Odyssey was that it was created initially to be an alternative to Saturday morning cartoons, but to air on the radio. And so we envisioned it strictly as a radio broadcast, sit down, listen to it at home kind of thing. What emerged over, almost 30 years.
So what year are we talking about?
That would have been 86, 87. It started for real in November 1987. So we're coming up on our 30th anniversary. And but I think if we did a poll of listeners, you have a group of people and kids in particular who will listen to it like every night at 8 o'clock before they go to sleep. But the predominant thing that it does is keep everybody entertained for long drives. It's become sort of the staple for people buy the CDs, or, you know, back in the day it was cassettes. CDs, they play them in the car and the drives just disappear.
Okay, so in the, but this is interesting to me though. Is this a how to say this without being offensive? is this a case of accidentally being innovative by being behind, in the sense that the Christian media world was so behind them, you couldn't really do animation, but you wanted to kind of replace the Saturday morning cartoon, and so you did audio only?
Well, it wasn't Christian in general. It was the fact that Focus on the Family at the time was primarily a radio enterprise. Dr. Dobson's broadcast was radio, and no one had the skill set at that point to even entertain what it would take to create something like this for video. Now, about 3 years later, they did. They created the Adventures in Odyssey animated videos.
They did.
Yeah. Around the same time that VeggieTales started. So,
So
they did it ultimately. But when we started, and it's also a less expensive proposition if you're going to test an idea.
So VeggieTales started like in the early 90s.
Yeah. I think the very first Odyssey videos came out around 91, 92.
It's funny because that's one of those things that I think VeggieTales is a clear example of something that like has an unintended audience. Like,
sure,
there was like a huge following for VeggieTales among stoner kids, and slacker yeah. kids, like kids like I can remember kids in the early 90s sitting around just getting stoned and watching mm-hmm. VeggieTales.
And I'm sure Phil Vischer did not intend that when he created the whole thing, but the funny thing, and the reason I even
it is kind of it's kind of surreal in that way, though. The whole VeggieTales thing is really surreal.
Well, I mean, it's funny, and he was heavily influenced by Monty Python. I mean, he just wanted to do something that was completely offbeat, and succeeded. I mean, and the style of humor, the way they approach things, is very Python influenced.
I mean,
it's to just this a day, very different thing.
Every once in a while, for no reason whatsoever, I will get the song stuck in my head about the hairbrush, about, oh, where is my hairbrush?
Oh, my word.
Oh,
the other one is...
where is my hairbrush?
No, in our house...
And it's Larry the Cucumber, who has no hair.
No, in our house, it was I Ate the Bunny. I don't even remember the context for it, but it was one of the characters singing about eating, I think it was a chocolate Easter bunny, and how he ate the bunny. Oh, I ate the bunny. I can't even do the song, but it's just so goofy, the songs that get stuck in your head. But... with this,
so Adventures in Odyssey. I'm sorry.
Well, the thing about it,
I drug you off into VeggieTales land here.
What's interesting to me about it was that, I mean, one of the key differences after I became Catholic was learning the Catholic market. What's different? I mean, I grew up evangelical, so Catholic is just very different. And I have a whole theory of what I've learned over the last 10 years as a Catholic. And one thing is, you know, the Protestant evangelical realm has an entire lifestyle-based reality to it mm-hmm. that is includes the arts media. I mean, that's why you have Christian films, so-called Christian films, and right. media. I mean, you have a whole music industry and book industry and things like that, because evangelicals are churched primarily because they want to be in church.
Right.
And then the drive in that, as you know, is then, well, how do you live this out in your life? And then ultimately it became, well, you live it out by listening to Christian radio and by playing Christian music and reading Christian books and et cetera. So all of this fit in when a Dr. Dobson said, these Saturday morning cartoons are having a bad influence on kids. And somebody said, well, do something about it. All they could do, because it was all they had at their disposal, money-wise and otherwise,
was
to create the audio. And it's interesting now because here we are, I'm at the Augustine Institute, and we're now moving into the audio drama world we released a life of St. Patrick called Brother Francis, Brother Francis the Barefoot Saint of Assisi. And it's 10 half hours, and it's created just like the Focus on the Family dramas, mm-hmm. high quality actors from England, the whole bit. But what we're now trying to figure out is what the market is within Catholicism. See, because if Protestant is lifestyle-based because it infuses right. everything, my theory and my argument has been that the Catholic reality is event-based. Mm-hmm. The people go to Catholic bookstores, the few that are left, or they go to buy first baptism stuff or first right. communion and things like that. But the idea of Catholic novels or novels that are Catholic in their essence or audio drama or whatever is still very foreign, because I think most Catholics tend to buy their entertainment or their media from secular bookstores, from Amazon, from whatever, and they may not be Catholic at all.
Well, what's so strange is that, and when we talked a little bit about this last time you were on, I have a lot of experience in the Christian music industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have, you have this situation where you have to have this blatantly evangelical music.
Right.
You have to have so many Jesus per minute, JPMs. You have to have this blatant kind of a thing. And then you sell it only in Christian bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's funny. You would think it's like, okay, well, they want to constantly kind of be reconverting themselves, so to speak, or whatever. But the irony is that this is in a world that theologically has this idea of once saved, always saved.
Mm-hmm.
So
well,
you're charging a battery that's full, so to speak,
well,
with this evangelical message.
Now, I was around when contemporary Christian music started, in essence, back in the late 60s and 70s.
I
was a Jesus freak before it became a DC talk song.
Yeah.
And initially, it came out of sort of the hippie movement, for, mm-hmm. you know, Southern California and other areas, of these guys becoming, and so especially in Southern California, becoming Christians, and Calvary Chapel back then was one of the big things. And so they become Christians and they decide, we are going to make music now. But they wanted to do it evangelistically.
Right.
And then within a few years, they realized, well, we're doing these evangelistic songs, but they're only being sold in Christian bookstores. So that's not helping anything.
Hold that thought. We got to go to the end of the break. I want to pick your brain on the Jesus movement a little bit. When we go. So you're listening to The Counterposition. I'm your host, Andrew Whaley. We're here with Paul McCusker, and we'll be back after the break. Thanks for coming out.
I'm a sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. See, only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media.
Okay, don't ever do that in front of me again. I don't even want to describe to everyone what I just experienced.
We can't afford special effects.
Yeah.
All right, we're here for Paul McCusker from the Augustine Institute of Adventures and Odyssey and the Father Gilbert Stories and Books fame, and now doing audio drama. And when we went to the break, we were talking about this strange beastie known as the Christian music industry in the 70s and 80s, and the idea that you would write these extremely evangelical songs and then play them to people that didn't need to hear evangelical songs because they had already been evangelized.
Well, they figured out that's where the marketing was. I mean, they started off trying to be evangelistic, and then they were only ever distributed in Christian shops. And that meant
because
only Christians were buying them.
Because the Christians were evangelicals.
Yeah, so evangelicals being a particular mindset of Protestant Christianity.
Right.
And in Catholic circles, too. But evangelistic is a big part of that. So then they caught on, well, it's okay. We can create music for ourselves as an expression of our faith. And so they started to do that.
Right.
But a lot of it tended to be pseudo-evangelistic, but
right.
Moved more into now praise, faith affirming. Let's just call it faith affirming music.
That's kind of the original praise and worship music.
Well,
kind
it did
of
because Maranatha Music, which was one of the first of that came out of Calvary Chapel. They started. I had the first what they called the praise album from 1971.
Wow!
And it's the precursor to what has been like the praise bands, the praise and worship music that's done now.
Yeah.
You know, so the marketing kind of drove where artistically things went. And now, of course, we have a whole generation of musicians who are approaching if we call it Christian music, they're approaching it very differently. The ones who aren't doing the praise and worship stuff
right.
are people like, I mean, dare I say 21 Pilots, for example,
yeah.
who come from a solid evangelical background, but their music is less evangelistic and less preachy and more of an exploration of ideas of spirituality right. and humanity. Well,
and in the early 90s, whenever I was going to Cornerstone and I was involved with the Christian music industry and I had a lot of friends and bands, we were kind of, our scene was the first bands that would write songs that were even kind of shocking and prophetic and mm-hmm. talking about the dark side of this culture and exploring doubt alongside faith and even just writing it was shocking the first time someone in the Christian music industry got their heart broken and then just wrote a song about mm-hmm. having their heart broken from the perspective of the being a Christian and didn't give you the nice tidy little thing at the end. That was shocking. That was absolutely shocking.
But what's fascinating about that is it's what you know. But if you go back 20 plus years before that,
yeah,
Larry Norman did that. Randy yeah. Stonehill did that. There were Christian artists when the record companies would allow it. Because remember, it's like for every author, there's a publishing house.
Right.
And the publishing house has guidelines that they'll allow the author to do or not.
So you're saying in the early 70s and that Stonehill and Larry Norman, those guys were doing
some of those guys
that.
Were exploring it. There's a song on one of Larry Norman's albums called I've Got to Learn to Live Without You, which could be taken two different ways. It's either right. about someone who suffered heartbreak and is learning to live without a lover or learning to live without a relationship with Christ because he's fallen away from it. But it did not have that kind right. of turn on the end that says, oh, but it's all going to be fine and I'll come back to you eventually. That thing that we often, and they still do it, especially in right. evangelical circles. It's like the idea of redemption they think of as singularly the personal revival thing. Whereas right. I think in the Catholic realm, we're in a better position to actually look at redemption from a number of different angles, but that's a whole other conversation.
Well, it's funny. It's like I, on one side, there is a really rich tradition and something really, really right in kind of that nuptial metaphor sense mm-hmm. of a song being able to be confused as a love song mm-hmm. and being a religious song. But did you ever see there was an episode of South Park when they started a Christian rock band and Cartman explained to him that the way you do this is you pick a cheesy love song from the 70s mm-hmm. and every time it says baby or honey or sweetheart or something, you change it to the word Jesus. Mm-hmm. And they did that and it became like giant. It became like
it's a bit cynical, but there's some truth to it. I mean, even George Harrison, there were songs that he did that sounded like love songs. But then he would say, well, I'm actually talking about my relationship, you know, with God. Or, I mean, that became the sort of, let's do it as a disguise kind of thing, subversive or whatever you want to right. call it in terms of let the listener figure it out. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to spell it out for everybody. And you see more of that now. I think contemporary Christian music is certainly far more open now to a variety of expression. And less so the, here's the formula, you got to stick to it.
Well, and going back to the public, for every author, there's a publisher kind of an idea. Most of the Christian labels are now owned by major labels.
Oh, and many of them major secular labels.
Oh, that's what I'm saying is major.
Yeah. So yeah, the secular
yeah, IRS
labels.
Records bought yeah. some of them. And like, oh, now yeah. it's like there's huge, yeah. there's a, I don't know if there are any. I mean, I've been out of that world for so long that
yeah,
I don't know. But I know that all the big ones got bought up and they're now subsidiaries of major secular labels. Sure. But I have a really bitter spot in me for that whole thing because I just knew everybody. I knew so many people in that world and I had friends who had tried to do business in that world and like get contracts to hold in that world. And it was worse than being in a secular world. There was just all the sin, all the weirdness, the affairs, all that stuff was going on. Mm-hmm. But then everybody was making a living by getting up on stage and acting like everything was okay. Mm-hmm. And their entire brand was around, we're different than the world. And even they had charts in the Christian bookstores.
Sure.
If you like so-and-so, then try listening to
these guys.
They were yeah. the alternative. They were the fat-free yogurt of the music.
The Christianized alternative to the secular thing.
The sanitized
protection. But see, I experienced that a lot in the evangelical realm. And it's a form of, and I think every, by the way, every religion has it. It's a form of exceptionalism.
Right.
And what happens, and the danger for any artist, I think, but let's say any Christian artist, Catholic or whatever, and you see it, you can see it with bishops, you can see it with priests. So it's not exclusive to any one group. But the reality is it's very easy to fall into the sin of thinking, because I am serving God. And I actually talked to one evangelical leader who pretty much said this to me. Because I am serving God, and because of all the people who are coming to him because of this ministry that I've started and what I'm doing, God's not gonna shut that down. So in his mind, having multiple marriages or where he had an affair or where he was doing things that were completely contrary to holiness, in his mind, he said, I remember this vividly. He said, remember, David, remember what David did, you know, and David was a man after God's own heart. I'm a man after God's own heart. David had an affair, but you know, God forgave that affair. And I remember in the conversation, I was aghast. I mean, I couldn't believe he was telling me this as a rationalization for his basically non-Christian behavior, that somehow he was the exception because of his giftedness and how he served God, which is a danger for anybody. But I said, but you're forgetting, after David's sin, the entire kingdom suffered. Nothing was the same after that. God forgave, but the consequence of that played out through the rest of his life. So what you think God is letting you off the hook for doing, everybody around you is suffering in this organization because of what you're doing.
You know, and we liked it. It's funny. I think that idea that there can be someone who's put in a situation, or because of their unique station or whatever, that they have a they have this ability to do something that others can't do. Like I was watching a show not too long ago, and it's set in LA, and there's all these there's this Roma family, this gypsy family, and they own all these fortune telling outfits. And it's all a scam, you know, but he says, there's a story. He tells him this tale to explain their way of looking at all this and their spirituality and how they can be so violent when someone steals from them, but they steal for a living. Mm-hmm. He says there was, when they were planning, he says there's a legend that says that when they were planning to kill Jesus, they had 4 nails, 3 steel and 1 gold for his heart. But a young gypsy boy stole the gold nail, and hence they only used 3, and they didn't put the nail through his heart. And so the Lord gave to the gypsies the ability to steal without sin throughout eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we can do this.
That's a remarkable rationalization. And very creative.
And they had this legend that was like defining who they were as a people.
Right.
Is they were the ones who could be kind of like Wily Odysseus or whatever, and be noble, but still lie and trick, you know, they were the tricksters. They were that was kind of who they were. It was at their core.
And they rationalized it in the way that lots of people do, whether they're big name Christian artists or preachers, pastors, whatever, they succumb to this idea. I mean, they rationalized in the case of a legend, but for most, it just simply becomes the enabling that happens by either the people around them who agree to look the other way, and they go, look at how God is blessing people. So it's okay that he has
it becomes a tacit narrative, or like a tacit legend that you're living inside of almost.
Right. Exactly. So it was fascinating to me to see that. I mean, you see it all of the time, and we've rabbit trailed dramatically. So I don't know. Maybe we should take a break and then come back.
Well, as luck would have it, we're right at the end of the break. So we're at the end of the segment. So let's go to the break. When we get back, we're going to figure out where we're going with this. And this is always a good time. It may not always be linear, but we always have fun, don't we, Paul?
Yeah.
All right. So you're listening to The Counter Position. I'm your host, Andrew Whaley, here with Paul McCusker. We'll be right back.
Then how we crave a hanging in his dark.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
people singing, please don't stay, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley, and I am here with Paul McCusker. I'm so proud that I have not called you Paul McGusker one time. I have, for some reason, vocally, I always try to do that. So I'm here with Paul McCusker, and we are talking about narrative and story and legend and audio dramas and whatnot. So you guys just did two in a row, two of these big audio dramas.
Yeah, we've got
one on St. Francis and one on St. Patrick, right?
Right. Patrick comes out, well, on St. Patrick's Day, actually. So we're still in post-production on that.
What a coincidence.
You know, what are the chances?
I mean, you know, the Lord just gives us those little weeks, doesn't he?
It was like the comedian who said, so they left Plymouth Rock and they sailed to this new country and they landed at Plymouth Rock. And it's like, how amazing is that?
So like, turn the boat, give everybody back on the boat. We're going around in a circle, boys. Oh, but, I love Eddie Izzard.
We're doing, and it's fascinating for us because St. Francis has come out, and now Patrick's coming next. And people hear it, they love it, and it's, I mean, I'm pleased to say it's very high-quality stuff. And
yeah, like Game of Thrones type
actor. We had a lot of British actors who've done tons and tons of stuff.
Big names.
Brilliant. But we're now looking to see what the Catholic marketplace will do with it, because nothing has been done like this in a very long time, if ever. And now it's a question of, well, will Catholics listen to this? And if they do listen to it, where will they live? Will they listen in the car? Is that where we think it'll happen most of the time?
Yeah.
Will families listen to it together? I mean, we're trying to figure out how it gets integrated into lifestyle. Mm-hmm. But more broadly, as one who writes not only scripts for audio dramas and for movies and stuff, but as an author of fiction, having come into the Catholic Church 10 years ago, in the last 10 years, I have been very curious about how storytelling itself fits into the broader Catholic marketplace. Because as of right now, there isn't much of it going on. I mean, of course, we have the Gospels and we have, I mean, those, the tried and true stuff that Catholics defer to. But as far as I can tell, most Catholics read the same fiction that anyone else reads. I don't know that anyone would even know what we mean, or very few people would know what we mean by so-called Catholic fiction. Often when you mention it, they think of Graham Greene and they think of various writers who might have written about Catholicism, but in a lot of their books, it was about the failure of Catholicism to actually endure real life. You know, the faith doesn't hold up against the complexities of real life. So that, to my mind, isn't necessarily the same thing as Catholic fiction. And the only big author right now is Michael O'Brien.
Yeah,
as a fiction writer. So, and I'm curious what this is going to mean.
He's one of the guys that's big. That's writing fiction. He's doing what would be the equivalent of like Christian fiction as a Catholic.
Right.
Now he, in his later work, seems like he's starting to cross over into, it's getting quality enough that it's becoming literature beyond.
Right. He has a new book coming out, science fiction. So he's dabbling in that. It's some, forgotten the title. Forgive me. It's Alpha Centauri.
Well, I read the Voyage to Alpha Centauri.
Okay. And
that was
so
good.
He is in the great position to be able to explore.
Well, A Father's
other
Tale
things.
Was, I tell you what, I got to the end of a 1,000-page novel and I was sorry it was over.
Yeah. And that's always a good thing.
That was amazing. A Father's Tale was really good. The Voyage to Alpha Centauri was really, really interesting because it was written in the form of a journal.
Yes.
And that was, I thought, just in itself was an interesting read. And that there were a lot of good, that would make a good film, actually.
Well, it probably would. And I think Father Elijah, I know they've been trying to do that. It's been under option by different film companies for ages to make that into a film. I'm not entirely sure what's holding it back.
Right.
But it's interesting because he's probably one of a very small number of names that you would think of when you think of fiction that is coming from a Catholic perspective. And with the audio dramas now, we're saying, well, is there an audience out there? Will people actually buy this? So, and will they engage? Mm-hmm. Will they understand what it is? Because, I mean, we started with Saints' Lives. Because that was sort of the low-hanging fruit anyway.
Right.
On several levels. For me, to explore the lives of St. Francis and St. Patrick was an education for me, because I kept thinking, if I can find their story, right, and I don't know the story, I wonder if these guys are much like everybody thinks they know the stories,
right,
but they don't really know them. And then they're surprised to find out that there was a lot more to these guys than they knew.
And these saints, especially St. Francis, his story has compelled people like Francis and Joan of Arc. These are stories that have compelled people. So you see like Nikos Kazantzakis, yep, you see like Franco Zeffirelli in the film world. These people have told, they've been drawn to this figure over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick, not so much.
Yeah, I can't think of too many films about Patrick. I know there was one done in the 90s that was awful. I watched maybe 5 minutes of it.
And oh, really?
Gave up on it. Patrick Bergen was in it, the actor. And they're hard stories to tell. But whenever I go into telling these stories, I try my best to stay true to the source material.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's not my life. I'm telling their life. And if I'm going to tell their life, I want to make it credible and compelling and accurate as I can based on the information I have, but then find the through line. For example, with Francis, it was fascinating to me that the main thing for him was that he envisioned himself a troubadour.
Yeah.
He was a performance artist. And so I kept thinking later in life, after his conversion, some of the big dramatic things that he did that we nowadays would go, that was completely over the top.
You're just nuts.
We're thinking he's crazy. And I'm thinking, well, he's a performance artist. There's a side of him that expressed his spirituality through a form of theatrics, which doesn't suggest that it was insincere. It was very sincere. Because I think for him,
very traditional. Look at Jeremiah.
And oh, yeah. It goes way back to
the Bible. He builds like that scale model of Jerusalem, and he's like knocking down the walls. It's like he's like.
Or the prophet that God said, I want you to marry this prostitute.
Right.
And she's going to be, because this is Israel to me. Israel's like a prostitute to me, and you're going to live this out actually in front of them.
Right. That's just, that just sounds crazy to us now.
With Francis.
And it was a little nuts.
It was fascinating because Francis, I realized at the deeper spiritual level, he believed that if he couldn't redeem something, he had to destroy it in his life. I mean, like the cut off your hand rather than sin with your hand. And that's where he cut off the things in his life. Anything, when we talked about this before, I may have said to him, a penny was like $100. He didn't want the penny because it would open a door for him that would take him back to a life that he had left behind of his wealth. And he knew the temptation. So he killed it. But what he didn't kill then was redeemed. So he sang the music he could redeem. He could use that for God.
Right.
So his story is a fascinating exploration of what motivates a saint, what motivates people to do the things that they do that sometimes seem extreme. And I honestly think you can only do that through story. You can write a book about it and you can tell it, but I think the power is in showing it, which is what I believe story does best. It's going to show you this person and dig into his life, psyche, spirituality, which is why some saints won't tell very well. There are some that are so internal that you think, wow, I've read this and it's so powerful, but it's good to read, but dramatizing it could be one long monologue that nobody will engage.
Well, I think the power of telling these stories of in particular saint stories.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously reading the lives of the saints has been a big part of the spirituality for a very long time. And obviously in telling and retelling the stories of the saints in an oral tradition, and us putting statues and naming our churches after saints and kind of taking their life and making it part of a charism or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's all part of it. What's interesting though, is, and the reason why I think it's so important, is that we think that in the back of our mind, we tend to think that we really let God have his way with us and we really were transformed into the image of Christ, we'd all be these cookie cutters. We'd all be exactly the same. But what you see when you look at the saints is that it's the saints who really become themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they're all so weird.
Mm-hmm. God is filtering.
They're so particular.
His spirit is working through the personality. I mean, it was C.S. Lewis and many others who basically said, you know, God is transforming us, but transforming us not away from ourselves, but into our truest selves.
Right.
But that means that an apostle Paul, you know, you had Saul, and he was very tenacious and stubborn and argumentative. And then he's converted. And guess what? He's still very tenacious and argumentative and stubborn. And it's fascinating because it's not like God negated personality in the people. That's why the story of a St. Francis is very different from the story that we're doing on St. Patrick.
Right.
Two very different men, very different thought processes, how God worked through them, through their personalities in their time.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing cookie cutter about it. They're two very, very distinct
Right, and then you start taking, you know, St. Teresa of Avila, St. Gianamola, St. John Paul II, these different saints, and you look at these people, you know, it kind of, I always think of it as kind of like we can only be part of ourselves. We can only be kind of ourselves. We can only go to about six, you know, if, without the Holy Spirit. But if you really let God, because he's the one that kind of designed you and he understands how to tune it to make it go farther. And it's kind of like, it's like this is Spinal Tap, you know, God can take it to 11.
To 11. This
saint goes to 11. I mean, when you take it to 11, anything, it gets very particular. And it becomes very much itself. It's very clear what it is. And it can communicate, that person, that saint, can communicate an aspect of the being of God that others can't. Quite.
And in the context of their time. I mean,
right.
God is calling specific people to specific times. And even though their messages may be timeless, and what we take from them in their time is timeless, they are very much of their time, which is, by the way, much like the Catholic Church.
Right.
All the timeless aspects of the Catholic Church. But then you have these snapshots of the Catholic Church dealing with its time uniquely in a way that's specific to their time because that's the way God does it.
Right.
Works through his people in the time.
In the moment.
Given.
But all right, speaking of the moment, we're at the end of the break and we're going to head off. And when we get back, I want to talk to you about the Father Gilbert stuff. Okay. So we're here with Paul McGusker. You're listening to The Counterposition. I'm your host, Andrew Whaley.
Then all the color glass that painter's palettes mash, all the colors of my soul.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to save. Love bedecked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely, and I'm dull.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley, and we are here with Paul McGusker, the final lap, the fourth segment. Here we are, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
You ready to go?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, so Father Gilbert, I just want to say, okay, first of all, I'm a fan. Like the first book, I just devoured the first book. Was it The Body Under the Bridge?
The Body Under the Bridge is the first one.
So, listeners, do yourself a favor, friend. Go get The Body Under the Bridge. It's a page turner. I mean, it's a if you're into like mystery suspense, especially if it has kind of a paranormal edge, but you have anything like an interest in kind of spirituality, really good read. I mean, it was just spectacular. I loved it. It was spectacular.
Thanks.
So let's talk about Father Gilbert a little bit. Let's talk about the motive for doing Father Gilbert and approaching this set of topics in this genre. And then I want to probe you a little bit. I want to ask you some questions about this genre and about this human experience of intrigue or mystery or fear.
Okay. Well, let me go way back.
Yeah, go way back.
I don't know if we've talked about this, but back in the early 90s, I read this book about U2 called To the End of the World To the End of the World, but it's by Bill Flanagan. And it was a behind the scenes thing about U2. And he had unlimited access behind backstage, the whole thing. And it recounts that period of Ochtung Baby through to what became pop. And what I was fascinated by was that Bono, he filtered everything through his Christianity.
Right.
And now when he does it actually through song or whatever, sometimes it seems overt, sometimes it's not. But he is constantly filtering everything through and processing through his faith. And I kept thinking, he has secular credibility, and he's doing this, but he's doing it unashamedly, and he's doing it in the way that he knows how to do it, through music.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, okay, if I'm going to do that as a writer, how do I do that? what's a credible way to explore spiritual themes from a Christian worldview? And out of that came Focus on the Family Radio Theater. Now, within that reality, as we were developing it, I independently began to, I had this idea. You know how you sometimes have ideas and you think, well, this is so obvious, a million other people must have thought of it.
Right.
And I had this idea of a Scotland Yard detective who becomes an Anglican priest.
Yeah.
And it appealed to me on several levels. One was that he'd have the edge of having been a Scotland Yard detective, and what was his story that led him to become an Anglican priest. And the Anglican at the time, because I was still evangelical, was sort of Catholic, but not quite.
Right.
Which I thought would be more palatable to an evangelical audience.
It was kind of Catholic light.
Yeah, Catholic light. So the marijuana to the heroin. But no, that's not the way to put it. I shouldn't have said it that way. So so I began to develop this idea of this priest, and then I was fascinated. I kept thinking, well, I'm fascinated by the idea of the paranormal side of it. Him getting drawn in, he's like a magnet for supernatural things happening. And why is that? And what's the backstory there that I could explore? So amazingly, Focus on the Family agreed to do audio dramas of the Father Gilbert mysteries, which astonished me.
Right.
They were open to it and they said, yeah, this is a great idea. Let's do it. So we wound up doing 9 that explored all kinds of aspects of.
Now, are those out there and available?
They're still out there. You can get them through Amazon or whatever. They're still
available. I
want
to listen to those.
And in many ways, they are the setup to what became the novels.
Okay.
Though you can read the novels without ever knowing about the 9.
Okay.
There are allusions to aspects of his life that now will make more sense when you go back.
Oh.
You're not missing anything by reading a book, and now the second one's out. It's called Death in the Shadows.
Which I just started, yeah.
So those two books pick up where the other one left off, where the series left off. But when you go back, if you go back and listen, we'll have to talk about now what now has deeper meaning for you from the books. But what I really wanted was a secularly credible way to explore spiritual themes. And Father Gilbert allows me to do that. Mm-hmm. And with the whole supernatural edge, I can now move beyond just some sort of theological discussion about whatever. I can now get into a whole other dimension, the other reality that we as Christians believe in, which was the spiritual reality.
See, it's funny. I used to go to Our Lady of the Assumption in Ventura, California, and there was Father, I think it was Father Steve, who's a former LA cop for 11, 12 years, mm-hmm. and he was a priest.
Yeah.
So I immediately had kind of a soft spot for this former cop who's a priest, because I had had a pastor like that I really liked,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that you see that actually strangely more than you would think.
Mm-hmm.
The second vocation.
Right.
And it makes sense. You've given your life in service and seen people kind of at their worst, and you've only gone so far and been able to help so much.
Right.
But you have this desire to help more, but you can't do any more as a cop. And so it makes sense that the cop to priest thing, especially back in the day when so many cops were Irish and
right.
and were Catholic, and there's the blue mass and mm-hmm. all, you know, it's like that was they still have those blue masses and all that, you know.
Yeah. No, and I think it was great because it allowed the internal conflict in the character. Because inevitably, somewhere in the audio dramas, and I think it's also in the book, somebody will get irritated with him and say, you're more like a cop than you are a priest.
Right.
Because there is a part of him that gets tenacious about solving the mystery.
Right.
And he gets tenacious to the degree that it throws people off because they think, well, this isn't very nice. This isn't how a priest should be behaving. And for him, he even wrestles with it. I think it's in Body Under the Bridge. You see him wrestling a bit about the line between his instinct as a cop and then his desire to help as a priest, and where one may be getting in the way of the other. So I love that about him as a character.
And the other thing I like about him as a character and as a detective, so to speak, mm-hmm. is that he has such a humility. We're so used to Sherlock Holmes being so in control, especially like in the newer versions of like Sherlock, where they're kind of narcissistic and megalomaniacal.
Yeah,
you
sociopath. They're sociopath. How they describe him. Yeah.
Yeah. He describes himself as a sociopath. Yep. You know, they're so self-contained and so confident in themselves. Father Gilbert is, he's not confident in himself. He's constantly questioning, and he's going about this almost reluctantly at times, being drawn into it. And it's the same motive that makes it's the same desire to get to truth and to help people.
Mm-hmm. And he's also trying to figure out why these supernatural things seem to be happening. And so along with the reader, he's discovering what's going on.
Yeah, and you're trying kind of to figure along out, for the ride with him.
Yeah, and you're trying to figure it out because there is hierarchy.
Yeah.
When you read books like Hostage to the Devil and the accounts, even Screwtape Letter, the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis and others, there is a hierarchy to the supernatural. There's a right. there's a hierarchy among in the demonic world. And I began to explore that reality.
Right.
That there are demons who loathe each other. I don't think they're capable of loving each other anyway. But you have the highly intelligent ones, and then you have others that are just brutes. There's not a one-size-fits-all demon, much like we don't have one-size-fits-all angels. And I thought, okay, if there's a whole other dynamic, and for some reason Father Gilbert seems to be in the crossfire
right.
of these realities, and I always intended to sort of work towards why, but I'll leave that alone for now. That allows me to explore things that a regular mystery doesn't allow me to explore.
And what's interesting is that, and this is a whole different show, but I'll toss it out there. It's like, from a theological perspective, how could something that is purely an intellect and a will that doesn't have a body
right.
be a brute?
Right.
But you do see, it does seem that at least there does seem to be kind of the Sherlock demon, so to speak, with a magnificent grand plan.
Yeah, the Moriarty type.
The Moriarty type.
Yep.
And then there's the one, and then there's just a borderline poltergeist that just loves torturing people.
Right. They're malevolent in different ways. And the reason I even think of brute or beast, and it's interesting that it would be a snake that I'm thinking of. We have a ball python at home. And it's interesting
that's just bizarre to me. Okay, people that have snakes scare me.
And he's fascinating because the way he nudges around his prey when we feed him.
Yeah.
And it's there are times when I think he'll strike and miss. And I go, you are an embarrassment to your species. There are times when he is cunning, but he doesn't seem to be very smart. And I realized that among the demons, you have very cunning demons, but they can actually be stupid in a lot of ways, which will irritate the demons who are actually smarter. So that reality then is fascinating to me, not unduly. I don't obsess
I think
over it,
this
but
is,
I like writing about it.
This is something that we should talk about at some point because I sure. think it's fascinating, the concept of the demonic and the concept that we as Catholics these things don't have bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a tacit acknowledgement that evil doesn't reside and originate in the flesh.
Right.
These things fell just fine without, you know, hormones.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Their temptations were dramatically different from, obviously, our temptations of the flesh. And yet, when you get to the heart of it, pride and all of the other things right. that go with it, it makes sense that it could still happen to them. But yeah, that's a whole other conversation.
All right, so where can we find all the stuff about you?
About me?
Yeah, so you can buy the Father Gilbert stuff on Amazon.
Right.
And, both the books.
I have a Facebook thing called Paul McCusker Writer.
Okay,
and W-R-I-T-E-R.
Do you have a website?
And there's a website, which is paulmccusker.com.
McCusker, yeah. It's two C's.
Yeah, it's M-C-C-U-S-K-E-R.
And
first name's Paul, but that's needs to be fixed up a little bit.
And where do you, where can we get this audio drama stuff?
If you're interested in the Father Gilbert audio dramas and the Father Gilbert books, they're at Amazon.
What about St. Francis?
St. Francis, we hope will soon be on Amazon. Right now, you can get it through Lighthouse Catholic Media. In fact, I'll tell you, go to airtheater.org. It's AIRTHEATRE or even TER .org, airtheater.org, and it tells you about what we're working on. There's some great visual promos.
It's Augustine Institute Radio, AIR.
AIR, yeah, at Air Theater, Augustine Institute Radio.
All right.
But airtheater.org.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Paul. Appreciate
sure,
you coming
for,
out. All right. Let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Counterposition. Thanks for coming out, kids.
I take your place, marble stone. I take your place, marble stone.